Well, welcome everyone to this panel entitled Fictional Bloggers. This panel is the brainchild of Liz Henry, the inimitable Liz Henry sitting right next to me. If you have not had the pleasure of getting to know her or any of her work, she has been exploring the issues surrounding fictive identity for quite a while now, both as a blogger, as a poet, as a translator, and as an academic, and as some other things as well. And she would like everyone to know that she herself has never pretended to be someone else online or otherwise done a fictional blog or hoaxed.
I would have you think. Yeah.
And that's why she brought me along. My name is Odin Soley, and I have been exploring the intersection of fiction and the internet since 1992. And I am probably best known for my blog, Plain Lane, which ran from 2001 to 2004 and generated a rather surprising amount of attention, media attention in retrospect. And I'll talk more about that a little later. But right now I'd like to turn it over to Liz to kind of give you the overview of what we're going to be covering and how.
Since this is a very fast session, I would love for it to be interactive, but we can do the interaction part more online. Where over here you can add, I know that people might want to say, oh, I know about this great hoax or this great experiment in identity, and you could add that to the wiki here, which I think that would be really fun. What I'd like to do is to go over very quickly my thoughts about the intersection of fiction and blogging or online identity and fiction more broadly. I'm like the literary critic and he's the actual creative content producer. So we can think of us that way. I'm not the actual fiction writer. But what I tried to do was, create some high level categories that talk about different ways you can approach fiction and blogging or fiction and online presence. We can think of fiction as an art form, or we can think of it as lying. When people talk about hoaxes, fiction is lying. It's complicated. It's the art of lying. And we can think about the different examples we're about to bring up here as existing on a spectrum of truth, openness, and secrecy. There's no clear ethical line saying here's the good kind of blogging as a fictional persona and here's the bad kind. I don't think we can really do that. And fiction also exists on a spectrum of depth, and I like Odin's terms were, that good fiction is thick and messy. So I really liked that, and as well good world building. So if we're building social networks of fictional characters and real people intersecting, then we could make them thick and messy and complicated. I love that. My high-level categories were original fiction, blog by author. So when I talked at first about fictional blogging, people would say things like, do you mean people putting a chapter of their novel online? Kind of. That could be one way of seeing it. But I think where a lot of the interesting stuff is happening is blogging as your novel's main character or even blogging as a host of characters. I want to talk about that. Role-playing games. I think that fiction has a lot to learn from role-playing games, especially approaches to collaborative fiction and world-building. Fictional ecospheres is another great Odin term. He comes up with these great buzzwords. So creating fictional ecospheres should be, I think, our goal. And if you think of the host of fiction of everything ever written, in fact, you could include history as a kind of fiction. History itself, you know, whether you think it's true or not is very questionable. That all of the textual universe that we know is kind of a textual ecosphere, a fictional ecosphere. We can look at personal blogging as fictionalized memoir. So when something perturbing happens to me and I don't want to upset my husband, I might say, you know, 15 years ago, this thing happened and I had this fight with this person who I make up the name. So I am telling the truth, but I am maybe lightly fictionalizing, my own memoir and testimony. And that can be a very hard line to play with. Obvious lies. Good examples are the Spirit Rover Live Journal. Chaucer Hath a Blog. Blogus Caesari. So we know we have sort of a social contract where we know that these are not true, that the Spirit Rover is not really blogging for us. Identity experiments, lies, and hoaxes are where it gets a little bit tricky. We have famous literary hoaxes, recent ones, J.T. Leroy, Nasij, who is, a white guy from San Francisco or somewhere, writing novels and books as a Navajo Native American author and winning grants and things like that. So a cultural appropriation issue, big time there. SJ, recent thing in the news, Wikipedia editor, who was posing as a professor of theology and took a lot of flack for that. cat herding, a very funny social media experiment in satire, creating like a hot chick who was talking about Web 2.0. That was pretty funny. Mixtures of truth and fiction that enter that push it more towards like a literary realm. I think Odin knows Brad Zeller, who has a very creative blog, that is a strange mixture of truth and lies. Infiltration and depth. This is one of the most fascinating examples you can find. If you're into Harry Potter fanfic at all, you've probably heard of this. Anybody? Harry Potter fanfic? Nobody's, oh, we have some people in the back. Okay. So MS Scribe or Ms. Scribe, I don't know how you pronounce it, created an enormous army of sock puppets who would attack her fanfic and attack her personally. Some of them religious conservatives or people who were stalking her. And what she did was she created a sort of weird world of these sock puppets who had some depth to them, who would attack her and her heroes, her fanfic literary heroes, together. And so they banded together with her and befriended her, and she infiltrated their world in real life and hung out with them as friends, and then it was exposed. So there's an enormous story. It could be its own book. It's fascinating. Theater-like creations like Lonely Girl 15. And then I thought of a funny example from history, which is that Benjamin Franklin started out his journalistic career writing as a housewife. I think it's something like Prudence Goodwife or House, you know, Goodwife Prudence. And he took a lot of flack for writing this advice column for women as a woman. So then we wanted to talk about marketing. Do you want to talk about marketing and publishers and the economic aspects that are possible here?
I certainly could. I'd also like to just kind of back up to expand on something that you mentioned earlier, which simply had to do with kind of what the internet and its interactivity has enabled, you know, truly the traditional relationship, straight consumptive relationship between reader and author to evolve. When I started out in 1992, just posting my, you know, .plan files for whoever wanted, at my graduate school, whoever wanted to read them, that represented a very straight and non-interactive way of, you know, paralyzing the type of content relationships that we have offline, in which, you know, I buy a magazine, I buy a novel, you know, what have you. I consume that, and unless the author happens to come by on a book tour, you know, I probably don't get any opportunity to truly interact with them. And basically, by the time, you know, we had hit the advent of blogging, and by the time those forms of self-publishing tools had evolved and you had comments and other types of feedback mechanisms, we truly had kind of entered a new context for authors and readers to interact. And that was really, as a writer, that was what drove me to launch Plain Lane. And so from 2001 to 2004, I blogged as a 20-nothing bisexual info waif who, you know, wrote a lot about her boyfriends and later girlfriends and tended to finish sentences with, hey. Believe it or not, this went from being, from my perspective, this was a chance to write fiction in a hurry, to really take a character and put her out there and have people interact with her in real time. Whether that was an email, chat sessions, commenting on her blog, you know, I posted something every day, etc.
Wait, you had chat sessions?
Oh, yes, yes. yeah, she got stalked a lot, actually. And chat was one of the favorite stalking mediums.
You didn't chat me. So I was a reader of Plain Lane very avidly. And people I knew, all my friends in real life, were reading Plain Lane. And we were all commenting and emailing and talking with each other in real life about, oh, my God, what is she doing? How could she go out with him? Or it was like our soap opera, and we loved her, we hated her, we wanted to slap her. And so it was very interesting when it started to come out that Lane's reality was questionable.
Yeah, and basically Lane's reality was highly questionable, as it turned out. You can see, there isn't even a family resemblance between myself and Lane. when that was revealed, and I had told absolutely no one in my personal life,
not even your wife,
yes. So the first that anyone found out about it, my outing, including me, was when my wife went out to get the front of the paper, St. Paul Pioneer Press, and there I was, outed on the front page. Obviously a very slow news day. what was really interesting, and what Liz referred to, is the fact that even though, you know, about a million people came across that blog, a million unique visitors over those 4 years, a really devoted commenter community of around 200 to 300 people evolved and really kind of extended the concept and came up with, you know, what really looks like a fictive ecosphere in which they're talking about what Lane did on their own blogs. They're having parallel conversations. They're commenting directly. They're giving me advice and feedback, which from a writer's perspective is, hey, new plot arc.
Yes.
And it represented what was a really, really fascinating kind of moment that, of course, culminated in her outing and gets into a lot of those issues which you brought up, which is, you know, what happens when you transgress feelings of truth and veracity, belief and trust. And, you know, from my perspective, that's what made it so powerful, because people truly did believe. If you go to a fictional blog and you're told that it's fictional, immediately look at how your reaction
I'll just show some and more emotional while you're talking.
Investment and whatnot changes. And so obviously in the hands of, you know, this turned out to be a relatively innocent hoax in the big scheme of things. But you can certainly see the power that exists there to manipulate people. And certainly it speaks directly to the way that a lot of some of the colder bottom line oriented corporations look at fictional blogging these days and the power of that kind of viral or word of mouth, you know, kind of collective buy-in.
I forgot to page through the pages that I had prepared. So while you were talking, I was just paging through some of those things. But yes, back to, actually you brought it around really, really nicely to marketing and product promotion. So I think a lot of people may know about the PSP2 blog that was a couple of months ago. You know, it was very lame. It was some marketing company called Zippitoni. Zippitoni, you really need to hire some real bloggers and some fiction writers or some playwrights who can really bring personality to a fake blog. The EU is passing a law, I've read, against falsely representing as a consumer. So what the PSP2 blog did was to make sort of a fake teenager who was like, I really want a PSP2, woo! And then the next day, it would be another post that was basically in really lame teen cyber slang that sounded fake. Oh my God, I still really want a PSP2, I hope I get one. And all my friends really want one too. So that would actually be illegal in Europe, I think, starting next year. Maybe it's in certain countries in the EU. It's illegal now, and in England, it'll be illegal next year because of people giving false reviews and doing this fake blogging or flogging. I don't know. other companies may want to do this with more artistry as part of my advice, which I'll get to in a minute. Publishers, as well as people who have product blogs may want to consider adding depth into their fictional realities. Fanfic is another model, like role-playing games and fanfic, I think, are great examples of places online and offline where, depth of world building and of character, people are experts in this field. That fiction as a whole is moving towards the ludic and ludology. Which means the science of play. So if we want to make things something interactive, we make it a game. So those of you, how many people play some kind of massively multiple, whatever it is, online role-playing game? You guys play it? So a lot of people play that, and that is collaborative fiction in some ways. And I think that has yet to be really explored in depth. And one thing that we were going to talk about, the ethical aspects of this, is that a lot of people were outraged about Lane. They were very upset. They talked about being violated, about trust, about a lack of ethics. I'm going to be like jabbing the knife here into you. They were very upset. In a lot of role-playing game theory, talking about what's happening in a group of people playing a game is that you have an implicit or explicit social contract that you know what the point of your lying, of your group lie is. And when we read a book, we know it's a lie, or maybe we don't. And people didn't know. And I think that was a problem. And that's also a lot of the problem with fake product marketing blogs, is that we feel insulted or we feel betrayed when we figure out that it's fake. So social contracts are a good idea to keep in mind. Consensuality, again, in fanfic, that world has various conventions of the genre where you warn people what kind of subject matter you're going to encounter in the story. I mean, you know if it's a Harry Potter Legolas crossover, and you know if it's non-con, it's non-consensual. So there are warnings that you may want to stay away from the story if that's going to upset you, but it also allows people to find what they're looking for. So consensuality is an issue. Authenticity violations, and this has something a lot to do with the arrogation of identity that is not yours. So I think some people might object to a guy taking on the identity and speaking as a woman, speaking for women, representing for women, other people may think it's a good idea. And like, in fact, did you feel that you understood women's experience?
I learned a tremendous amount doing that, obviously. Walking a mile in someone, or 4 years in someone else's shoes, it was a fascinating insight into, kind of online existence as experienced by a woman who, granted, shared quite a bit about her personal life, but still wound up, in essence, dealing with any number of stalkers over the years, as well as a great number of far less dangerous, interactions with typically men.
Well, the people I knew who read you were mostly women, who read Lane. And we were jealous. We were like, how come Lane can blog about her weekend and get 70 comments like that? And we're, aren't we interesting? Yeah. So it's kind of funny. Authenticity violation, you can think of this in relation to cultural appropriation, which is a big issue right now that people are talking about in the science fiction, fan and critical communities. That this is a problem. It's good because you get to walk a mile in someone else's shoes, and it may expose things and expose people to ideas they may not have thought of. But as a member of the dominant culture, you may be speaking for others in a way that's more palatable to the dominant culture. So you may be replacing the voices of somebody else who may actually know something about being that kind of person, whoever it is. But authenticity, we do question whether, we really are anyone. You are Lane. Do you feel like you are Lane in some way? Did you become Lane-like?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Very, yeah, a lot like that. Yeah, that picture. No.
your growth as a person?
No, certainly, certainly.
Or the things you got feedback for?
Yeah, and personally, if you knew my writing career, I've always been interested in folks who look nothing like me and have lives nothing like mine. And so consequently, I've always been fascinated with otherness, whether those are other life experiences, other genders, other ages, etc. And so from that perspective, Lane was a wonderful experience.
I like how you said other genders. That was nice. That was, I approve. Yes, so we have lessons to learn. And I wanted to say, should we just kind of skip this stuff? Well, no, because I actually wanted to make the point that fictional characters should establish a deep online presence. And that I think that we have interesting possibilities here that suddenly, Hermione Granger is my example. Hermione Granger's profile on Twitter will suddenly become valuable property, and maybe somebody will claim that they have the intellectual property rights to that.
Yeah, well, and obviously that ties into all sorts of issues. 10 years ago I was involved with a startup that worked very closely with major media companies, holders of TV licenses, broadcast licenses, largest publisher of women's magazines in the United States, et cetera. And the whole goal was to find a paid content model. And, of course, what we're ultimately seeing is that, there is no successful monetization, particularly for long-form fiction online. And so, in fact, what we're witnessing is very akin to, the entry of China and India into the global labor market. There is an absolute surplus of writers and content online driving down, value at zero, below zero, et cetera. And so consequently, it's very difficult, to envision a means in which publishers can really team with writers, in a way that, would reward that enormous opportunity cost that goes along with, creating, a long form, fictional piece and sharing that online.
Yeah, so that was part of my closing advice that I wanted to. I wanted to have the whole argument about whether what was ethical or not, but maybe we can do that at the very end, because I did want to talk about that. We do need, as Odin says, we need more monetization models. There are different possibilities, and in fact, on the main page of this wiki, I just had the sort of the brain dump of all of our ideas. If you want to go in and look at that, I think Odin had great ideas about different ways we might monetize fiction. Or that publishers might.
Yeah, well, and I'd like to get paid for doing stuff online. Wouldn't we all? And yet, in reality, if you take a look at, my friend Paul Ford, how did he get, Gary Benchley Rockstar published? That began as a serialized novel online. Yet the monetization had to happen offline.
But more people probably read it online and might still
absolutely
be reading it
absolutely
than the 1,000 people who maybe bought the book.
Absolutely. And Plain Lane similarly. I wish I could share the entire Plain Lane thing with
you. So why don't you? There's my hard question for you. Why are you trying to get that published as a book? Why don't you just keep it online?
Because there is at least the chance that it will get published as a book, and a monetization model will go along with that. Whereas online, it's not there yet. So.
Okay.
How's that for an evasive answer?
That's an evasive answer. I disagree with
Ask
you. I think
my
that
wife.
You would get
no.
that it'll all pay off for you someday if you put it online and have faith. But that could be because I'm really foolish. So I think that about the ethical questions and the law in the EU against doing it, do we really want to make fiction illegal? You know, do we want to make lying online illegal? I don't. You know, if we think of fiction as pure art, we can't really think of that anymore. It's, if it's being published by a publisher, it's already, you know, kind of contaminated by capitalism, and we can't say that it's not pushing forth a product. I mean, maybe the product is going to be the movie that comes from it, et cetera. So we can't stop it. People are going to be doing it. So if they are doing it, I'd like them to, you know, do it with skill and artistry and depth and messiness and thickness. And also just this advice that, you know, you will be caught eventually, as Odin was caught, in a long, interesting process, which is, you can probably find the ghosts of online, of people all collaborating and trying, you know, on mailing lists and trying to track down Lane and, collating all the evidence. So I would advise people to do it complexly, keep it consensual, don't lie, have a social contract. And to hire and pay novelists and bloggers and role-playing gamers, playwrights, screenwriters, to create deep worlds and identity networks.
Yeah, and that's definitely what I would like to see happen as well. You can already see it with the advent of, some of these media properties like Lost, et cetera. You know, what we're seeing is a tendency for Hollywood to make very thick, very open-ended, very kind of protracted properties, which then enable, you know, us to participate online typically in ways of extending those and investing ourselves in them, extending the discussion, et cetera. Massively multiplayer online role-playing games are, in many respects, represent a similar type of openly architected means of establishing that type of fictive ecosphere. I think that will only tend to increase for a couple reasons. One, I mean, it's obviously, it ties back into a monetization model, thus that, publishers can benefit from. It really shifts the cost of creating content to users like us, and yet at the same time, you know, kind of reifies our belief in and consumption, you know, of those media properties, of those characters. And then the messy question really becomes, what does the DRM and IP models look like that go around those? I happen to work for a startup that spends a tremendous amount of time worrying about IP. Granted, not in the literary sphere, but, companies really worry about this. At the end of the day, your IP really represents the core assets.
I'm just thinking about that, about who owns identity, and a lot of what I've been suggesting in the thought process leading up to doing this panel is that we want multiple identities, not of me having a multiple identities myself, but we want to have 200 or 2,000 Harry Potters blogging in different blogs. Yeah. That would be fun. 2,000, you know, Nevilles, you know, or whatever. I'm just using Harry Potter because a lot of people have read it, but it's not like I'm a fanatic fan. But maybe a little. but we want that, and we want to know, what would Harry Potter have to say to Genghis Khan and Carolyn Ingalls, you know, if they were all blogging? What conversation would they have? And I want to know that. And I think that that's part of, like, the depth and richness we can add to history, like, into fiction. So, but of course, then when it comes down to, what if someone starts blogging as me, that would be disturbing. So hopefully people who are, like, alive can own their own identities, maybe. Do you have anything else to add? We could open it up if people have questions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or, you know, comments that they want to add. Yeah. Well, I think it's a pretty fuzzy line. Yeah, it could be lying. Well, I know that people in real life get slash fiction written about them. I mean, we have that. What's the Richard Stallman and the other dude? I forget. Somebody wrote a very funny slash fiction. And there's a Steve Jobs, Bill Gates one. I mean, yeah, they're alive and people are writing fiction about them. So you're asking me whether that's ethical or not. I can't really answer that. Right, yeah. So. Right.
Yeah, I actually think that's. Yeah, I think that's actually one of the really nice things about fictional blogging is because you're not, you know, kind of necessarily taking stuff from your own life. You are free to truly invent. And so, you know, Liz and I, in fact, were talking about this prior. We were sitting in the green room. We were talking a little bit about this, and she was mentioning what she had to do to write or, you know, discuss something from her own life. It was a little bit of a protracted process, changing genders, going back 10 years, posting it on, you know, posting a blog out of time and space. And yet from my perspective, you know, being free to just, you know, completely leave my own life behind and operate as a writer and completely invent parallel characters, parallel universes, et cetera. That's the nice thing. Then I avoid that dilemma of which you mentioned.
Hello? Hello? Can you hear?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. I wanted to ask about the Plain Lane guy. How much planning did you do for your story and the story arc? And did you have trouble keeping up with the community people who were throwing comments at you?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, by the end, when Plain Lane was getting much more popular than I ever imagined it would, I called it Feeding the Beast. Because her audience, if she, for example, had a weekend and didn't post immediately on Sunday night or Monday about whatever debaucheries or, you know, fun or misadventures she may have had, her community would get very worried, and me being me and not Lane, I would get concerned about, you know, the hunt being on, the chase being on, and getting discovered. And so certainly at the end, I felt tremendous pressure to publish. Otherwise, I really did like doing fiction in a hurry. I would give myself, you know, I'd be lucky if I had an hour to crank out a post every day, and that's what I would try to do day in, day out. And so over those 4 years, I did somewhere in the neighborhood of like almost 800,000 words. And
wow.
So, but yeah. I wish that would have made it a lot easier. No, I didn't. I didn't. And to be honest with you, Plain Lane's community, user community, became really my greatest source of inspiration.
I actually started to twig to that. Okay, everyone says, oh yeah, I caught on before it was revealed. But I felt inklings that something funky was going on. Because there would be these arguments about whether Lane was realistically having realistic lesbian encounters. Like, she went out on a date and had sex on the first date. Oh, that would never happen because lesbians don't do that. People would say that in the comments. And I would come in and go, well, actually, you know, and I would say, I disagree with you 70 people that just commented. And I think that Lane, I think you should go for it. I think you should date her. It's not a mistake. And I would go on and on about it. It's kind of embarrassing, but I start, and then you would do it.
Yes.
Lane would do the thing that was the maverick thing,
arc.
And that would become a story arc. And I would think, huh, that's funny. Either I'm having way more influence on this person who's a lot younger than me, or it's kind of half made up.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, there were people who knew from day one that Plain Lane was a fictional character. And I was fascinated by those folks because they still
Joshua Norton from Seattle was very skeptical.
Yeah. And yet he continued to kind of play along and participate in it. And so there was a subset of those community participants who, you know, kind of knew what was going on and yet were really enjoying the experience, apparently, the genuine emotional experience they were getting from this interaction and enjoyed the community and just didn't want to, you know, say the gig's up. So. Actually, when that happened, there were so many folks who were deeply emotionally invested in the character's authenticity that they would actually defend the character for me. And so I really didn't have to say anything. So it'd be like, you know, get off this girl's back. Of course she's real.
Oh, God.
But that was very good feedback. I mean, I took all that feedback to heart and used that to make an even more believable and authentic character.
I have three questions. They're related, I believe. The first is this, that deceit often has bad consequences for the deceived, as we heard in the last talk. If you practice deceit in this form of literature, do you feel any responsibility for the consequences? That's question one. You can pick any. I'll give you all three. Okay. The second is, I think you made the claim that somehow fiction that is not effective as deceit is somehow compromised. Does that, in fact, leave all the great works of fiction that are available now somehow in a state of compromise that We shouldn't be reading Shakespeare. We should be going out and reading a blog, not knowing whether it is actually true. And the third question is this. What, in general, is the literary contribution of this form of fiction?
I think the last one is the hardest one to answer because that's still very open-ended.
Good. You answer the last one. I'll answer the others.
Oh, no, I don't want to answer the last one. I want to answer the others.
Oh, damn. Go ahead.
I was going to say, in regards to your second question, I think the biggest issue there is from the perspective of someone who writes as opposed to, you know, kind of blogs per se, blogs my own life on the internet. My frustration is that users, by and large, are socialized to expect interaction, to expect presentations of authenticity, etc. And so, given the fact that it's very hard to read a novel online, on your computer screen, etc., not a very convenient form for consuming long-form fiction, you know, as an author, I feel almost compelled to kind of try to jazz it up or to do something to help readers, you know, kind of buy in and read along. My wife doesn't read my stuff because she just hates to read stuff online. Doesn't matter. She'd much rather read a book, for example. And in
yeah. What the literary merit.
Tell
but
that
we don't
to my
need
grandma.
To. We don't need to pretend that that's real in order to really believe in correct, the identity yeah, of the characters correct. And to have a relationship with them. So I think we have relationships that are very strong and deep with fictional characters. I know I do. So, but I would like to say about the first questions about ethics. I did kind of just paste a little bit of a rant in here when I was actually reacting not to you but to Nasij, the fake Navajo writer who was award-winning and everything, was that this has to do with testimony and our ideas about testimony and personal stories and memoir writing. So we writing before, I'm just going to read what I wrote because it sounded smarter than when I talk. We write testimony before an imaginary courtroom of witnesses, something that was made suddenly clear to me by listening to Beatrice Sarlo talk about testimony and memoir in Argentina and the Dirty War. When our belief in one person's testimony is destroyed, it violates a sort of social contract and all testimony is undermined. And I believe that to be the worst and strongest effect of this kind of lie. So if we disbelieve in Lane, are we going to disbelieve in everyone online? Are people going to disbelieve in me and what I write in my personal blog because they think that I might just be fake? You know, that I might not really exist. That's perturbing if you undermine social trust. So, yeah, I would agree
and
with yet, you that it's a fuzzy area.
Yeah, and yet I would argue to some extent, we really do need to look very, very hard at social trust. I mean, do you believe my LinkedIn profile? You know, I mean, just think of all the different ways that you represent and misrepresent yourself in daily life, in conversations with each other, et cetera. And so, let alone to, you know, talking about, you know, issues of very, very big and important political import. And so consequently, you know, I think that there is utility in the fact that, you know, a hoax does play an important role in helping reset our assumptions about authenticity.
As well as anonymity. Who was just coming up and telling, was that Claudia telling me that telling us before that there are bills on the floor now being discussed, to outlaw blogging as without disclosing who you really are. That's very disturbing, especially for people who may not be safe blogging about their real lives. So anonymity, especially, you know, from my perspective, women and being able to speak as a feminist, often people have pseudonyms and that's important to them. Yeah. Are we over time? Okay. Oh, okay.
Oh. Actually, that was exactly the point I wanted to raise, and I wanted to raise it quite specifically. I do a lot of work with human rights workers in developing nations and often in very repressive nations. And what we end up advising people to do is create a persistent pseudonym, protect themselves through Tor, so on and so forth.
Ah.
But, of course, the question that comes up is how do you believe anyone when they're behind a persistent pseudonym? And so, on the one hand, I love the artistic freedom that this medium gives you. On the other hand, I sort of want to, you know, throttle you and sort of beg you not to work in this medium in as much as it constructs this really interesting problem Because now the Zimbabwean government or the Ethiopian government or the Egyptian government or whoever's trying to silence speech suddenly says, well, we know about all these internet hoaxes. How do we believe that Sleepless in Sudan is really an aid worker in Darfur? Obviously, this is someone's terrific novel and nothing bad is actually happening in Darfur. So I'd love your reactions to that.
I think that's a very salient point. And actually, prior to Plain Lane, I was doing a blog. I was very interested in Islam. And I was doing a blog that was about a Arabic-American journalist and aid worker in the Middle East, in the occupied territories of Israel. And after 9/11, I quit doing it. I mean, 9/11 happened, and I was just like, holy smokes, this is really bad. You know, I could not be anywhere near authentic. There are discussions taking part of the, this could be very destructive. So I definitely feel, the impact of that argument. And also, one of the things that inspired me to try Plain Lane in the first place was, I don't know if anyone remembers the Casey Nicole, scandal, but, that was a case where someone was really, basically playing a character that, or presenting a character as real who's dying.
Was it the brain cancer girl?
I don't know what cancer she died of, but, or supposedly died of, but, or, you know, you can take a look at fictional characters who exist simply to try to get folks to, buy off their gift list. And so Plain Lane, she never had any way for people to give her money or, otherwise involve her that way. So certainly I understand that that's a real double-edged sword there. Questioning authenticity is good, especially when it comes to, weapons of mass destruction and where they might be located. And yet, the flip side to that is that, there really are people who rely upon anonymity and pseudonymity for their physical safety and the expression of their political beliefs.
That is a great point. I feel like we should wrap up because there are other panels and people have to go to dinner. But if you have stuff to contribute, please do contribute it to the wiki or email us and I'll put it in.
Thank you
so
much
for
your
coming.
Time.
I can't believe so many people came.
Thank you.